Today's Taisho will be on case 83 in the Pien Lu, the Heikigan Roku, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 83 is entitled Umon's The Old Buddha Communes with the Pillar. Main subject. Umon spoke to his disciples and said, "The old Buddha communes with the pillar. What level of spiritual activity would that be?" And he himself gave the answer for them, saying, "Clouds gather over the southern hill, rain falls on the northern mountain." Secho's verse, "Rain on the northern mountain, clouds over the southern hill, 4 sevens and 2 threes, I see them face to face." In Korea, they assemble in the lecture hall. In China, they have not beaten the drum or rung the bell. Joy in the midst of pain, pain in the midst of joy. Who dares to say gold is the same as soil? So today is the Saturday of our August 2018 session. And I want to thank everybody for making an outstanding effort in the Zendo this morning. I'm so glad to see many of you arriving last night. I'm so glad to see all of you arriving last night. And many of you have been here before, and I'm so happy to see you again. And some of you are here for the first time, and I'm very impressed by your sitting. It's really quite wonderful to see people here for the first time sitting so wholeheartedly. So thank you for your efforts, everybody. And, you know, your effort contributes to everybody else's effort. You know, when you sit still, you don't move, you're in deep concentration, other people notice that, and they sit still too, and they benefit from the energy you help to create. So it's definitely the case that sitting together is far superior to sitting by oneself because of this amazing collective energy. And, you know, when we sit together in the evening at the university, or we sit together on Saturday, there's that collective energy. But here it's very special. The special energy of Sesshin is kind of very focused, wholehearted practice, hour after hour, day after day, is really just, it's like nothing else humans have invented, in my opinion. There's nothing else like this in the universe. So thank you all for making this amazing event possible. And here's to many more. So the subject of this koan is a Taisho, a very brief Taisho, by Master Umon, which is Japanese for Yunmen. This was a very famous Zen master named Cloud Gate. So Cloud Gate said to his disciples, "The old Buddha communes with the pillar. What level of spiritual activity would that be?" So, you know, if you were in any temple in China, you would see, and India, any temple in India, you know, there would be a hall for sitting, a Chan hall, a Zendo. But, you know, before steel beams, there would have been pillars in the hall, because a large expanse like this requires supports. And so, you know, when you were sitting in the Zendo, you would have been often sitting next to or facing a pillar. So the pillar is like a fixture of any temple in India or China that you would have seen in olden times. And so the koan is simply the old Buddha communes. Part one of the koan is the old Buddha communes with the pillar. If I were to give you this koan, I would just say pillar. Usually, every koan has a turning phrase or a turning word, and in this case, it's a pillar. Now, I won't spoil anything if I tell you that, basically, when we sit in zazen for many hours a day, something happens to us. And those of you who have been here for 3 days now understand, if you didn't already know, what happens. You know, we come to sesshin with busy minds, distracted minds, and we're usually organizing our lives around our personal selves, which is perfectly okay, right? It's okay to have a personal self. You know, every 2 weeks I get a paycheck, and I definitely want that paycheck to go to me and not to somebody else, you know. And on the other hand, you know, the house payment, that could go to somebody else. That would be okay. I get up in the morning like everybody else. I do my zazen. And then, you know, I have breakfast. And I might think, do I want green tea or black tea? What would Kurt like this morning? And then I think, what will I have for breakfast this morning, you know? Do I want, you know, this or that? And, you know, I might look in the refrigerator and there's melon, there's apples. What'll it be? Melon and apples, you know. You know. Then I go upstairs and I think, okay, I've got a big meeting today. I wanna wear my power shirt, you know. It's not much power, it's not much of a shirt, but all the same, it's my power shirt. You know, I have a couple shirts that I sort of hold back for dressy occasions, right? And a pair of shoes, you know. So maybe I have to meet with the dean and I want to wear my power shirt, you know. So, you know, basically, you know, I want to present an image and so on. So this is our lives, right? You know, I had lunch with our new department chair a few weeks ago, and she's a fantastic person. And I was trying to impress her, so, you know, she's a very well-traveled person, and I said, you know, there's a great restaurant in Piscataway called Souk Sagar. And she went and she said, oh, this food is wonderful. And, you know, she said, you know a lot about Indian food, don't you? Yes, I have to say I do. So we all do it, right? You know, we all do it. And that's sort of our normal life. But it's important to live that life. It's important to be a self, and to value yourself, to do things that interest you. Those are all important. You should never. Buddhism has nothing to do with punishing the self, or nothing to do with hurting the self. That's not a path to wisdom. The Buddha tried that and said, this is not working out. Please don't do this, you know. So it's important to value yourself and take care of yourself. My second teacher, Webb, always used to say, take care of yourself. You know, but on the other hand, you know, that's a very shallow life. And when we come to sesshin, we begin to realize how shallow a life that is. You know, we begin to realize there's so much more to who we are than that person. You know, who can be disappointed if somebody doesn't like a restaurant, or who can be disappointed if, you know, somebody doesn't like something you do. You know, I do all kinds of things, and I remember once, I run a writing program at Rutgers. That's my job. And one of my jobs is to create a reader that freshmen at Rutgers have to read. They read these selections from different essays, different books that I've read, and I spend a lot of time and care selecting the material and editing the headnotes and the footnotes. And so I remember I was going into the lounge, the faculty lounge, and I heard this graduate student, she didn't know I was there, and she was talking to somebody else, and I was just going in to use the coffee machine, and I heard her say, "Oh, I really hate that dark little book, you know." So it hurt my feelings, right? It's like, well, I thought it was a wonderful book. It's not a dark little book, you know, come on. I was just sad, you know, it made me sad. And it made me cautious the next time I went into the graduate lounge, you know. I always make a lot, I started to make a lot of noise when I went in so everybody could see me, right? And so they'd all say, "Oh, I love this book," and I could believe they like it even if they don't. So, you know, the fact that little things like that can plunge us into dejection or make us afraid to go into a room, you know, that's sort of, that's one way to live. But, you know, when you come to Sesshin, you discover that you have a bigger life. It's a much bigger life that we... It's like there's the cliche, the tip of the iceberg, right? You know, this is very much the case. We live on the tip of this iceberg, and we don't have any inkling that there, as it says in the sutra we recite, the vastness that underlies us all. You know, so. So, you know, when we come to Sesshin, first day or two, we're still sort of living out that small self life. And so, you know, when you're at Sesshin for a day, especially the first day, you know, a lot of those loops are playing in your head. You're still having an argument with your coworker in your head, or with a spouse or a parent. And you're still smarting from something, you know. You know, by around day three of Sesshin, those things can seem so unimportant. You know, it's like, oh, who cares? You know, who cares? Yesterday I was ready to throw myself off a bridge, and now I don't even care. You know, it doesn't matter. And that shift is really quite, I think, interesting, right? It shows how much our everyday lives are a kind of game or fantasy that we take. We need to respect the self. We need to have a self. You need to be a person you're happy with and be a person you have respect, you know, be somebody you respect. But on the other hand, you know, if you just live in that life, it's such a pity, because there's something, there's so much more to who we are than that life. And, you know, on day one of Sesshin, we're mostly just playing those tape loops in our head. And then gradually, you know, as we go through the hours of sitting, they begin to recede. And some of the first couple of days of sitting feels like a narrowing of focus, right? It's like, you know, by around day two, you're just trying to get through the sit. You know, you're just trying to just follow one breath at a time and deal with the pain in your legs. So it's like your focus has gone from, you know, whatever your job might be and your family, down to like this little instant, you know, just, I have to get through half an hour of sitting, my leg hurts and I just have to follow the breath out and sweep the pain away, and follow the breath out and sweep the pain away, and follow, and this is like this contraction of our awareness, right? So this is a contraction, right? It's everything changes. You know, you're just trying to deal with like the elemental things, right? You know, surviving, basically. Getting up, I have to get up, get to the cushion, get through these hours of sitting. And pain, even though nobody likes it, and pain is not, nobody likes pain. I don't like pain. And you shouldn't be in so much pain that your teeth are chattering or something. That's very unproductive. It's definitely the case that Buddha rejected that kind of mortification of the flesh type thing, you know. But you know, if you're uncomfortable and you're trying to sweep that pain away, that's really liberating. You're also sweeping away all the non-essentials. You know, the world is full of people who think they're deeply enlightened. That's really true. And who aren't, you know, if I may say who aren't. And they sit around and they read great books and have great thoughts, and they might study the Buddha sutras. But you know, often those people avoid coming to sesshin because you know you can have all kinds of fantasies about yourself. But when you come to a sesshin, you know, about 4 hours in, you realize, hey, I'm not the Buddha, you know. And that's so important, right? That's so liberating. It really cuts the crap, you know. It cuts through all the crap. And it's very purifying just to be focusing on the elemental things. This breath. You know, the first thing you did in the world was to take a breath. And the last thing you will do is to take a breath. I mean, I have actually been with both of my parents when they took their last breath. And it's so wonderful to take a breath, right? It's so wonderful. And in fact, you know, when you narrow your consciousness down to just something like the breath, you realize you didn't understand the breath at all. You know, because we live in the small self life, you know, we hardly have time to look at anything carefully. But when you begin to follow the breath, you realize the breath isn't what you thought it was. You know, we all know what the breath is. But when you begin to watch it, you realize it's doing some very strange things. You know, when you watch the breath, maybe you begin to notice that your breath disappears, or your hands and face disappear. And you notice that if you keep watching the breath, after a while, there's like a shift in your consciousness. You begin to go blank. You know, one way to think of it is that at the end of your breath, there's this clearing, this empty space. Some people experience it as a open space. Some people experience it as a dark space. But you know, around day 3 of sesshin or day 2 of sesshin, when I look around, I can see people. You know, they're resting, and they're so still. Their faces look different. It's like their bodies are at rest, and their face is completely placid. And I know that at certain times during the day, they're in a thoughtless state. See, so, you know, it's true that we narrow consciousness down to a certain point. But then at that point, there's like a shift. It's like there's a change in consciousness, like an altered state of consciousness. And we enter occasionally this thoughtless state. And you can feel the qualitative difference. You know, when you begin to enter this state, we call it samadhi, ding. Samadhi is this altered state, and you can feel it. It's like you feel like you're in, personally, I feel like I'm immersed in something. You know, it's a very grounding. It's like going home, or you feel like you're very. Sometimes people feel like parts of their body are disappearing. Sometimes you can feel like you're solidly planted on the earth, but you're beginning to experience everything in a different way. And one of the things you experience is all of your senses begin to operate differently. You know, when you're not distracted by the constant flow of chatter in your head, you know, everything around you becomes vivid and alive. So, you know, around day two, if you're a beginner, around day two or day three of Sesshin, you'll notice, you know, maybe now on day four, when you sit down and you have so few thoughts, you know, the sound of like the cicadas outside, it's just mesmerizing. You know, you're listening to that, and in a very different way. You're listening to that in a very different way. It's like you've become transparent, and the sound is just moving through you. Yeah? See, this is an altered state of consciousness. This is samadhi. And actually, you know, if you stay in that state of consciousness, you know, you're beginning to respond to things in a very natural way without reflection. So, you know, when we can enter deep samadhi, we're beginning to have access to our, what we call in Buddhism, our big mind. This is our unconscious mind. And I said that you know, basically the human being is like the tip of the iceberg. Well, consciousness is like the tip of the conscious mind. You know, I want, what will I have for breakfast, blah, blah, blah. That's a top. But underneath us is this vast unconscious mind. And you know, when we enter samadhi, we're beginning to turn, you could say, the controls over to the unconscious mind. We're beginning to access or be available to the unconscious mind. So you know, normally, normally we are a little bit out of touch with that mind. You know, we live so much in the small, chattering mind. And as I said yesterday, you know, when you do that, sometimes you can feel very drained or very deadened. But one thing that can happen to you when you begin to get access to the iceberg underneath is that you begin to feel very energized, very alive. Everything seems very crisp. So, you know, one way to understand this koan is that it's about something we all do. You know, if you practice Zen, we all commune with the pillar. You know, we all commune with the iceberg, basically. You know, we sit down on the cushion and we begin to focus the mind on the breath with one-pointed attention, and then we begin to go into deep samadhi, and you know, then we begin to experience the world like in this transparent way, and we begin to access the unconscious mind. And in our tradition, Zen, the way we do this is by practicing meditation on wu, or emptiness, mu. So after you've worked with the breath perception meditation and you can enter samadhi with regularity, the teacher will ask you to work on emptiness meditation, calling wu or calling mu. And you just sit on the cushion and call mu. And you know, for a long time, this is difficult to do because the small mind doesn't like that empty space. You know, as soon as the small mind encounters emptiness or blankness, it tries to fill it in with chatter. And so, you know, just as when you're watching the breath, it's hard to get through the chatter to get to the breath. When you're working on mu, it's hard to get to the chatter and get to the empty space. Because there's a kind of, most of the chatter, most of what goes on in our heads is not really thinking. You know, every once in a while we actually have to solve a problem. So, you know, when I was in the restaurant business, you know, we would have 100 customers coming for a special lunch. And one of my jobs was to help order all the stuff. So you'd have to say, okay, there's 100 customers. Each one is going to have one of four items, you know, lasagna, chicken cacciatore, you know, manicotti, you know, and there was a trout almondine, you know. So, you know, we had to calculate, you know, based on what we knew, how many people were likely to order this, and then we'd order, okay. But a lot of the time, chatter in our mind is actually not performing any useful function. It's actually just a defense mechanism, right? So a lot of the chatter that goes on in our mind is an expression of our anxiety or our fear, or maybe we feel we're out of control. You know, people now do this with technology. So I notice that when my students come in, when I encounter young people, I notice how often they're texting, you know. And I think they're texting in transitional points in their life. You know, they're on the train or they're going somewhere. Some of it's boredom, but I think more of it's anxiety. When they feel like they're not in their familiar environment, you know, they start texting and they feel connected to something. It doesn't matter what they text. It's just a response to anxiety. And I think a lot of thinking is like that. So when you're working on the mu koan, you know, that empty space can trigger a sort of anxiety or uncertainty. It can trigger anger. It can trigger a sense of, you know, like I'm not good enough to succeed at this. All of your karmic obstacles can be triggered. And one way the mind responds defensively is to just sort of start sending out the chatter. So when you work with your koan, whether it's breath perception or any other koan, you need to get into samadhi, and then you want to keep focusing on the koan, and you each out-breath, you focus on the breath or you focus on the koan, the turning phrase. So if it's pillar, 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 you want to just keep doing that so that the chatter doesn't have a chance to really get going. You know, you'll notice that the chatter starts when you get to the end of your breath. So as you get to the end of the breath, it starts and you get to the empty space. Your mind begins to empty out. Your chatter starts. So you want to sort of cut it off before it can get going. So you say pillar, and then pillar. And in those spaces, thoughts are going to start to sprout up. But you want to not allow the sprouts to get going, because once they get going, they immediately create this dense network of thoughts. Chinese Buddhism, they're called creepers or vines. So you want to cut the sprouts before they get going. And you do that by focusing intently on the turning phrase. So pillar, pillar, pillar. And as you do this, you'll notice that the thoughts begin to decrease and your mind begins to become much more focused as you drop into samadhi. So, you know, one way to think about this koan is that it's like a textbook of Zen practice. You know, the old Buddha communes with the pillar. When we do zazen, we're sitting down and we're communing with the big mind, the unconscious, by entering samadhi and then wuxin. And actually, wuxin is a special kind of samadhi. So all of that makes sense, you know. All of that makes sense, and it's like a textbook of Zen practice in this one little koan. But why did Yunmen say the old Buddha communes with the pillar? Why didn't he just say the old Buddha goes into samadhi, or the old Buddha communes with his true nature? Why did he say the pillar? See, so every koan has a little hook or a little trick. It's there's something there that doesn't add up. If there's a koan that goes like this: what is Buddha? And the Zen master says, mind is Buddha. And we hear that koan and say, oh yes, mind is Buddha, that makes sense. Well, if it makes sense, you know you're not going to answer the koan. See, there must be something wrong with that statement, and you have to find it. See, something's missing. So when you get the koan that says, what is Buddha? Mind is Buddha. We all know, oh yes, Buddhism is all about the mind. So if you say, yes indeed, Roshi, mind is Buddha, wrong, okay? That's the wrong answer. There's something that you're missing, see? So there's always the koan is always pointing to something that you're not seeing. So the obvious answer is never the answer, actually. So why doesn't he just say the old Buddha communes with samadhi, or communes with his true self? Why does he say communes with a pillar? So you know, one way to answer that question is to think about, you know, basically when we think about samadhi, when we think about consciousness, we think about it as in our heads. So you know, we say, I am here. I'm in my head. And outside is the outside world, see? So we often say, you know, you will hear people say, when they talk about meditation, they'll say meditation is an inner tradition. But you know, how is that true? You know, is it the case that, you know, I'm in here and the world is out there? You know, the way people in our culture think about it is actually, you know, we think that the real self is like a little person in our heads, behind our eyes, looking at the eyes are like windows, and the real self is looking out at the world. Like, that's how we think, you know. So inside me is the real me, and it's looking through the windows of my soul, my eyes, at the world. See, now that may be a profoundly confused way of looking at things, and it may be false. It's a hint, it's false, okay? So, you know, we say, I'm in here and the pillar is out there. But you know, actually that may be a function of our confusion, in here, out there, see? There may be no such thing as in here and out there. I mean, hopefully we'll all have a chance to explore this at greater length when we work on the koan. But you know, when you're in deep samadhi and you hear a bird singing, you know, the boundary between yourself and that bird disappears. And you feel that you are the bird, yes? Well, that may be reality. You know, that's reality. When you feel separate from things, that's the illusion. That's the illusion. So you know, when we say there's the in here and there's the world out there, we may be thinking with the small mind. The small mind says this is in here and that's out there. But an awakened mind realizes everything is my body. Everything is my life. You know, and the deeper we go into our practice, the more the boundary between ourselves and the world begins to disappear. We experience everything as our body, everything as our life. So what does this mean In practical terms, what does this mean in practical terms? Well, you know, one thing about Zen practice that's easy to fall into is the assumption that all the work that happens on the cushion. You know? So when we're working on our koan, we might be waiting for the answer to come to us on the cushion. And we get off the cushion and we go brush our teeth or we lie down for a while. So there's on the cushion and there's off the cushion, see? But that too may be a mistake. So, you know, if your koan is pillar, you know, on the cushion you can sit there and think pillar, pillar, pillar. And that's essential. You have to spend many hours in deep samadhi saying pillar. But, you know, when you're off the cushion, walking around, please say pillar. See? And you begin to realize that actually your practice is continuing off the cushion. And many people answer their koans off the cushion. You know, they're working on a koan, they're sitting deeply, and they're in the kitchen, or they're eating their rice, and suddenly they have an insight. In other words, you know, practice isn't limited to the cushion. You know, as you serve the food, you can be thinking pillar. As you cook, you know, chop the eggplants, pillar. You know, so please don't allow the cushion to be the boundary of your practice. That's based on this. There's what happens on the cushion, and then there's the world. There's what happens on the cushion is subjective. What happens on, don't fall into that trap. It's all one thing. It's all one complex system. It's all one life. And it's all one system. Your consciousness has no content apart from what's happening around you. You know, So it's very difficult to say where your mind starts and other people's minds stop, or where the world starts and where you start. See, so those boundaries are really an illusion. So please, you know, when you're working on your koan, it's okay to take a break. You know, if you're sitting on the koan saying pillar, 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 you know, maybe you just want to go for a walk and take a break, and please do. It's very refreshing. Sometimes that's when you get your insight. But don't limit your practice with the koan to what's happening just on the cushion. When in Zen, there's something that's very important to Zen practice. It's called the doubt sensation. If you read any book on Zen, they'll talk about it's necessary in Zen to have the doubt sensation. And it's never well explained in any book. You know, in fact, there's supposed to be three pillars of Zen. You could say great trust. It's sometimes translated as great faith, but it's not quite right. It's the trusting mind. Great trust. See, that's the first pillar of Zen. The second pillar of Zen is great determination. Everybody here has great determination. Not you came, you've been sitting, it's wonderful. So great trust, you have great trust or you wouldn't be here too. You're sitting 8 hours a day without any guarantee that you're going to get some kind of a payoff is definitely great trust. And people who have that kind of open-heartedness, who are willing to trust life to that degree, are quite rare. And I'm so happy to meet all of you, because it's so hard to find people who are willing, who have that kind of trust. So great trust, great determination. And the last one is great doubt, see. Now, great doubt is not clear. And it definitely, I mean, look, if you're at a session for 5 days, around day two you're having a doubt, that's for sure. You're thinking, where are those car keys? You know, let me out of here. And indeed, some of you just arrived, but we did have somebody who looked for who left in the dead of night, right? And he began to have doubts, you know. But that's not what's meant by great doubt. Like, what the hell am I doing here? great doubt means, who are we? Where do we come from? And where are we going? See, I've got to know. You know, people say this and people say that. I want to know. You know, I want to take the curtains back and see what's behind the curtains. If it's just the little guy pulling levers, you know, that's what I want to, I've got to find out. And if it's the Buddha, I've got to find out. And whatever is back there, I've got to find out. And I don't know. See, that's great doubt. I don't know, but I've got to find out. So, you know, when I was given the koan, breath perception koan, my teacher said, I want you to watch the breath. Genki Roshi said, here's your koan. Breath with eyes, where do you go? And I thought, oh, brother, breath. You know, I know the breath. It goes in, it goes out. You know, I actually said that. I said, well, it goes in and it goes out. You know, it's like, and ding, you know, that he rang the bell, like, interview over, you know, back to the drawing board. And it took me so long to realize that I didn't understand my breath at all. I had never really encountered my breath with great doubt. You know, what is the breath? You know, so you watch the breath and all of a sudden you realize, this is odd. You know, I can't find my breath. Or you're watching the breath and you think, my breath is coming out of my forehead. That's impossible. But it feels like it's coming out of my forehead. Or as you're watching the breath, you feel like there's electricity in your hands or something. See, those are direct, immediate experiences of the breath without any interpretation. It's just what's happening right now. And you get to that experience of the breath by suspending your certainty and entering a condition of great doubt. I've got to know. Okay, so maybe I don't understand the breath. What the hell is the breath? And now you start watching the breath intently, right? Intently. And you begin to realize, this is very strange. You know, the breath, my breath is peach colored. I've told this story before, but you should never discuss your koan training with anybody. When we were doing breath perception meditation, I couldn't answer. Genki kept saying, tell me about the breath. And I said, goes in, goes out, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then I tried other things. I tried to be creative. I wrote poems. I couldn't pay attention. I couldn't cultivate great doubt. I didn't know how to have great doubt. So anyway, we were driving home from a session, and one of the people in our group was a professional dancer in a Seattle dance company. Her name was Gina. And she did what you should never do. Really, please don't do this. But on the way home, she was talking about answering her koan. And she said, yeah, I was working on breath, and I went in and I told Genki Roshi, peach. And he said, that's a great answer. Yeah. So later, I tried peach, right? How embarrassing, right? And I think he knew I must have ridden home with Regina in the Volkswagen. So, you know, I couldn't cultivate great doubt. But your breath is different from somebody else's breath. You're going to experience it in your own way. But you know, when you're working with your koan, you know, cultivate great doubt off the cushion too. So, you know, what is this pillar? And you're walking around and you're thinking, pillar? You know, there's no pillars here. You know, you walk outside and you see trees, maybe those are pillars. You're thinking, pillar, pillar, pillar. And what you're really doing is you're going to give your unconscious mind a chance to communicate with you. And as you're walking around saying, pillar, 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 something might strike you. You know, something might powerfully strike you. And you might begin to think, oh my gosh, you know, this is a pillar. And it might not be what you think. It might not be an upright something supporting something. You know, you have to be open to the communications of your big mind, your unconscious mind. So practice doesn't just take place on the cushion. It takes place off the cushion. And as you're walking around, you can say your key, your turning phrase. And suddenly you realize, gee, this is a pillar. This is a pillar. This is a pillar. So please, please don't limit yourself to the cushion. That inside outside is a complete fantasy. It's the small self experiences itself as separate from everything around it, and it experiences mind as a realm of privacy separate from everyone and everything else. But the big mind is nothing like that. The big mind is nothing like that. No boundaries are seen. So big mind is everything. Everything is your big mind. So, you know, Western people also think of the unconscious as like a realm of privacy. You know, but the Buddhist unconscious is not like that. It's everything is your true nature. Everything is your true self. And everything is trying to help you wake up. So, you're doing an excellent job. Umon spoke to his disciples and said, "The old Buddha communes with the pillar. What level of spiritual activity would that be?" See, in the monks, this often happens. His monks don't know what to say. So he said, then he gives the answer for them. He says, "Clouds gather over the southern hill. Rain falls on the northern mountain." Where does yourself start? And where does the world start? See, who am I? My small self says I'm Kurt, but maybe if I'm in deep samadhi mind, in great doubt, I realize, ah, who am I? Clouds gather over the southern hill. Rains fall on the northern mountain. Secho's verse, rain on the northern mountain, clouds over the southern hill, 4 sevens and 2 threes, I see them face to face, looking like looking in a mirror. In Korea, they assemble in the lecture hall. In China, they have not beaten the drum or rung the bell. Joy in the midst of pain, pain in the midst of joy. Who dares to say gold is the same as dirt?